Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today I want to welcome J.P. Haig. He is a researcher and writer with an interest in unidentified aerial phenomenon and the mysteries through a balanced approach and mindset. He is also the national director of MUFON in Mauritius. He considers esotericism, spirituality, and science to be all the right tools and lenses for a better understanding of the layers of reality that surround and interact with us, worlds within worlds. And he will also be a presenter at the upcoming Forbidden Knowledge NewsCon. JP, welcome. How are you doing today?
It's beautiful to see you looking so well, despite the tumultuous world events that we're both and all of us as a whole are living through. It's been just about over a month now since we caught up at the Laughlin UFO MegaCon.
Yeah, so,
it's been longer. It's been about six weeks.
Yeah. I was just about to talk about that. We got to hang out at the Laughlin UFO conference. It was an amazing event, and your presentation was mind-blowing. It really resonated with me, especially when you spoke about the phenomenon as being much more than just UFO and extraterrestrial contact experiences, but it embodies all the metaphysical and paranormal phenomenon, and it seems to be all connected in some way, at least I believe. And I think your experiences and research can bring us closer to understanding the phenomenon and connecting essential pieces of the puzzle. But first, I don't want to spend too much time talking about our current global situation, but I would like to know, and for the audience, what is it like for you in Mauritius right now, which is in the Indian Ocean, right?
Yeah, that's right, Chris. We're a few hundred miles off the east coast of the large island Madagascar, which listeners or viewers may know through the Disney Pixar franchise, which I love. But we are this tiny little island that's about 30 miles in width and about 40 miles in length. And we're in the middle of the Indian Ocean. There's nothing south of Mauritius until you actually hit Antarctica. So we're in a tropical climate. We're close to the Tropic of Capricorn. We're relatively isolated, but we do have, at present, I think it's 144 cases of the coronavirus, and we've just suffered the fourth death. So that brings us to just under 3% death rate, which is kind of in line with what was anticipated. I think it was the World Health Authority that were passing to national, the governments, the estimated figures. So we're at the lower end of that. But the government, in fairness, has reacted quite quickly. So we're currently under full martial law, as you would call it, over in the States. We don't have the right to leave our homes. All the shops are closed. And we've been under that for over a week now, within just around 2 weeks of general lockdown. So, we're told that the shops, the food shops, are going to reopen as of Thursday of this week. However, there's going to be limited access to the shops. They're going to basically allocate people access through their surnames, and that will basically equate to two visits a week. You get half an hour in the shops to get what you want. You have to go in a sort of in one direction. And if you miss anything, it's tough. You have to keep going and pick up your stuff. It's a bit like a supermarket sweep game show that I can see in the making. So, look, I think they had to do this because there was a lot of undisciplined behavior, and people, even though it was entirely unnecessary, there were plenty of products in the shops, not too much crowding inside. People were still in that mode of fear. And when you're in fear, you sort of switch off and start to go into survival mode. So you had people just reaching into the same freezer compartment for the same food, even though there was plenty. It's sad. So anyway, the government have reacted. They've treated everybody like children, which I actually think needed to happen because I was seeing it with my own eyes. And we'll see if, people have learnt and can, conduct themselves with a little bit more order and discipline and dignity, actually. So I'm hoping that it's going to work out okay. Most people are keeping to the curfew and respecting martial law. It's not nice. It does feel a bit like house arrest. We're hearing this term battered around quite a lot. But I actually think that this is kind of necessary for now. I've said before, there is quite a fine dividing line between democracy and autocracy, but the real difference is it's constantly under review, and it has to be with a view to allowing people to resume their civil liberties, you know, within a direct and proportionate and reasonable amount of time as possible. So that's where we're at, Chris. But you're right, we don't want to get too bogged down into this. But what I would just say to everybody is just keep your cool, carry on, as we say from England. And, you know, try not to fear the situation. Just be pragmatic and calm and do what you can and pull together wherever you can, because ultimately we're one giant family on this piece of rock that's orbiting around the sun 365 days a year, and we need to basically get our stuff together in order to win this game.
Yes, yeah, very well said. And you know, I think that I just have this feeling in my gut that everything will be okay. It may take time. I also think we talked about this before the show. People can get into trouble with ultimate belief in some of these theories that are going on social media and the internet. It could be very dangerous. I mean, I believe it's okay to explore these, to take a look at them, to see what's going on. But the second you start ultimately believing something, and there's no way to verify it, it can be dangerous, especially when you're trying to get other people to believe the same thing. It seems like there's some sort of mass hysteria going around social media. I made a joke post last night listing about 7 or 8 different theories that are going on right now. And, you know, like I said, I think it's okay for people to look at them, but we need to kind of take a step back and try not to have like this ultimate belief system that, yes, this theory is what's going on and we're doing this. And I know it, you know, I'm going to tell everyone that this is what it is because that's what I believe. So I think that's where, you know, we could run into a few problems right now. But yeah, other than that, I have a feeling things will work out okay. And yeah, that's all I really want to end that portion on.
Yep. No, I would echo what you said, Chris. I think that there is a lot of information around. There's a lot of fragmentation. There are things that don't quite add up. But if we jump into a position, even if we really think that it's true, we, you know, risk placing our own credibility at risk, first of all. And second of all, we're just going to mislead people by accident, even if it's well-intended. And I just think that caution is necessary. I think that conspiracies absolutely exist. And a conspiracy by definition is an agreement in secret between two or more people. They happen every day. So there's no problem there in that there may be a conspiracy of a kind in terms of how it's being handled, or indeed where the virus may have originated from. I think there's something like 8 different strains that we've just been told are circulating around the world. And that was on Yahoo, Yahoo News. But then equally the day before, Yahoo News made the effort to publish an article whereby university researchers in the States somewhere had verified that the virus was indeed natural in origin and not synthetic. The thing to really look at in a virus, from what little, you know, biology I understand, is to determine whether it's synthetic or man-made versus being natural, is to look at the outer shell. Because apparently if this outer shell doesn't really mutate, then it's synthetic. And these are called protein keys. So that's the thing to watch for. And there was very little information on this until that particular article came out. I'm not saying that, you know, it's either one way or the other, but I just think we need to keep an open mind. Agendas, of course, exist in the world of all kinds. There is obviously a massive financial and economic impact that this situation creates, which can be used against or can be even, you know, for good or for bad, to be honest. I don't see huge amounts of mass arrests taking place within the celebrity and leadership circles of the world. But, you know, I'm open-minded to anything and everything, but show me the evidence and then I'll maybe be able to give more of a view. So anyway, to end that little piece, I think we're both 100% in agreement. Yeah.
Yes, definitely. So let's get to your story and experiences. You have had a lifetime of fascinating, extraordinary experiences. So let's start at the beginning. Where did this phenomenon kind of start with you?
Okay, I suppose it's funny. I was recently on George Knapp hosting Coast to Coast AM.
Great interview,
the first
by the
person.
Way.
Thank you so much. I'll send you the check after the show for that kind comment. But actually, it's just you and George, you in private when we were at the conference that really asked me about this, and it got me thinking because actually, and I think this may have been the case with you, but you know, we're not sure. It really started from a very young age, but I wasn't entirely conscious of it. Very strange little things were happening, and I just dismissed them as normal or in later life as so-called, quote, psychological phenomena, unquote. You know, there were incidences where I'd be doing my homework in my bedroom and, you know, a little Coca-Cola bottle magnet would just literally levitate off the table, move across and down the table, and then slowly place itself back on the table, you know, without falling over. And I remember, you know, phoning up a friend to just tell him, you know, you won't believe what's just happened. You really won't believe it, but it did happen. Or I would be, you know, lying in bed and I could feel my body levitate from the bed. Now that could be, you know, a form of astral projection, which William Bullman excellently spoke about at the conference we just attended, or it could be physical levitation. I mean, this happens with the yogis that go into retreats and they meditate. I know one it's happened to. And so, you know, there's a reason that these myths or stories around different traditions exist. So lots of strange things like that. I mean, even recalling the Gulf War that took place in 1990, which was a really terrible sort of incursion and conflict that happened. And I was a child. I didn't really understand what was going on. I remember seeing, you know, the news presenter on the BBC News fronting this with, you know, a grave look on his face and gravity in the tone of his voice and a picture of an RAF fighter jet in the background. And this little voice in my head would just say, this isn't real. This isn't real. This isn't real. And, you know, it didn't mean anything to me at the time. But, you know, as we alluded to a little bit earlier, I think there are, and we know that there are, you know, major world events that have been staged, such as the Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam. And, you know, maybe this was we can call it the higher self or an aspect of conscience, or maybe it was an external intelligence other than myself that was just giving me little kind of crumbs of information as I was growing up, but, you know, without fully cognitizing or understanding it. So that was really, these are just a few odd examples from when I was very young. But really, I suppose I walked into an initiation of maturity back in 2012 when, you know, it was in the lead up to the birth of our daughter, who's now 7. And, you know, my wife and I had got married. We were engaged. We were looking to buy a house in the south of England. And that was the first time when we were looking to buy in this old town, I saw an apparition. We were house hunting, and it was a 100-year-old coach house that we walked into. I could see the seller was pretty uncomfortable with inviting us in. I didn't really know. I didn't smell bad at the time, so, you know, anyone's guess. So we walked in, and she showed us around the house. It was midday. The sun was coming in through, you know, into the house without any issue. It was a beautiful, sunny morning and then afternoon. So she shows us up into this bedroom, and we walk in. My wife walks in, then the owner walks in, and then I walk in. And as I walk in, I just think immediately to myself, wow, this is a really old house because they haven't dusted it. There was this thick dust that was just sort of in suspension in midair. But then as I was watching this dust, it began to vibrate. It became quicker and quicker and quicker, to the point that this, what I thought was dust, began to take a solid form or an appearance. And it was basically a being or a person, a woman, I would go as far to say, that literally just manifested like a sort of a light being of some kind or a ghost. And she or it had these kind of white robes, and it approached me, and then it walked through me. And I felt this immense heat. I felt comfortable. I felt this electrostatic kind of energy or fuzz around the face, which you used to pick up when you touched the old kind of tube TVs in your living room. And then it disappeared. And then I said to the my wife and the homeowner, did you just see that? And they said, see what? We didn't see anything. I said, come on, this this being just appeared in front of me, a ghost just appeared and walked through me. And I said to the lady, just something intuitively said to me, she's selling you a haunted house. So I said, you're trying to sell us a haunted house, aren't you? And she agreed. She said, yes, I am. I'm sorry. This is the reason why we're selling up. We're really, you know, we're shit scared. We see lights flashing at night in the bedroom. We hear a disembodied voice. We feel watched when we're alone. I mean, it's pretty uncomfortable stuff. She came clean. So, you know, that was the first full-on kind of paranormal experience, I suppose, or apparition I had up close. In the end, we actually did buy a haunted house in the same town because nothing appeared to me when I was actually looking around, and that was pretty chaotic and unbelievable. So that was the first kind of...
I was going to ask you, you went to purchase this house, found out it was haunted, and then end up purchasing another haunted house, right?
An actual haunted house. And I kind of realized, well, you know, we bought the place. It was built in 1900. It was Victorian. And we were kind of renovating it, aspects of the house. And on occasion, we'd come out from London and stay over in the spare room. And one night, in the dead of night, and it was freezing, you know, the heating wasn't really working properly. My wife was heavily pregnant, bless her. And we were in these sleeping bags, you know, keeping warm. And in the spare, again, or in the guest room, there's this sort of chimney place. And then in the dead of night, maybe 2 or 3 a.m., I hear this coughing that's coming up through the directly up the chimney stack next to where I'm sleeping. And I know that the origin of that noise or coughing, which was a man, by the way, was coming from the dining room, living room fireplace just below, because it had to come from the same chimney. So, I mean, at that point, I thought, damn, actually, this house is probably haunted. But I didn't want to tell my wife. I didn't want to freak her out. But in the end, it became unavoidable. I mean, we eventually moved in. There was, you know, heavy banging underneath the master bedroom. Chairs were being pulled from underneath the kitchen table in the dead of night when I'm changing my daughter, her nappy. The electrics would cut out. You know, perhaps they were using the electric supply to try and manifest. What else? Pillars of light stood or appearing next to my baby daughter sleeping in her basket when I walked in. Very thin, sort of narrow beams of light.
These houses were in the UK, correct?
That's right. This was in an old town called East Grinstead. And this is a very curious town. It's based on one of the main ley lines that run through, or alleged ley lines that run through the south of the UK. And, you know, these dragon lines or ley lines are associated with earth and other energies that basically help, I believe, to manifest this kind of phenomenon. And I say kind because I think it's more than just ghosts and you know, ghouls and apparitions of that ilk, but also with perhaps the UFO phenomena too. And interestingly enough, the UK and European, if not world, headquarters of the Church of Scientology was only 2 to 3 miles away from our home. And we had the likes of John Travolta and Tom Cruise often coming to the town to come and spend time there. And there was a very odd incident that I spoke about, as you may recall, at the Laughlin UFO Megacon that was reported in the national press in the UK. And this took place at the end of, I think it was December 2011, around New Year. And from recollection, I think something like 6 British Airways jet aircraft pilots spotted between 3 to 6 silver discs hovering or landing on the lawns of this Scientology headquarters. So these are credible eye spotters that know how to fly commercial jets and take the lives of all these passengers into their own hands. So, you know, that was intriguing enough. But not only that, the airport, which is called London Gatwick Airport, which is actually nowhere near London, it's about 70 miles away and based in my home county of West Sussex. But not only the pilots that saw this thing, so did the radar. So they physically picked up the reflection of these discs that were hovering over this very curious location of the Church of Scientology next to, or a few miles away from where we lived. So, you know, it is a very strange place. There seems to be high amounts of activity. So this kind of really set the scene for moving to Mauritius in the Indian Ocean, where we are now. I mean, there is another incident I should probably mention that I've overlooked, and that was actually seeing my first UFO or UAP, which actually happened in London before we bought the house and moved into this this nice town outside in the countryside. And that was, I think it was end of 2010 to the opening month or two of 2011. It was definitely sort of winter, but it was a really beautiful, clear blue sky kind of day. And my wife and I were walking back from seeing a film in a place called Finchley Road, which is in central, north central London. And we were walking south to southwest back through a beautiful location called St. John's Wood, which is really where Abbey Road is, Abbey Road Studios, where the Beatles and all manner of artists record their have recorded their albums. And we were on this sort of elevated hill, and we're walking back. At the time, I'm working as a lawyer in London in a top law firm, one of the world's leading law firms. And in the evening, I'm researching this UFO phenomenon because somebody, a friend, an engineer who basically helps run the computing system of an international bank in Canary Wharf in London, showed me some really strange images from what he says were deep space telescope images of what I can only describe as light ships or partially formed or etheric type ships that were just literally sat in the cosmos. And he said that this was leaked. And I said, well, it's probably Photoshop, right? And he said, well, we don't know. But anyway, that triggered this kind of interest, and I began to research in the evening. And it just took me to amazing places. There was a genuine information block on both sides of the Atlantic, in the States, the UK, and generally in Europe. So that's the kind of context where we're walking home from the cinema. I'm walking with my wife on the left-hand side. She's on the footpath, and there's this kind of tree-lined avenue, so she can't really see the skyline ahead. But I was on the outside of the footpath, and I could see just past the trees and over I could see ahead, and it was Notting Hill, which is famous for the Hugh Grant film, but you can see it from an elevation. So we're walking back. And in my mind, I'm starting to think about the subject again because it's consuming me, like I know it has you and others. And in my mind, I said, is this phenomenon real or not? Intellectually, I'm persuaded on a balance of probabilities, which is a civil burden, the civil burden of proof in a civil court of law, whereas in a criminal court of law, it's having to prove that a criminal act was done beyond reasonable doubt. So it's not as far as that. But it's still, you know, on a balance of probabilities, if I have to go one way or the other, it's this or it's not this. And I had been persuaded intellectually, persuaded by the evidence, nothing to do with believing blindly or anything like that, that this phenomenon was on a balance absolutely real, that there was something within me that just couldn't quite digest this. It's just so beyond, it's mind-bending stuff that you're seeing and researching. And so I'm saying to myself, on a balance, I know it's true, but I can't quite believe it. Is it true? And at that very moment that I pronounced the words in my mind, is it true? An object pulsed in and out of reality up to five times, four, five, at that kind of pace. And it was like a sort of a metallic diamond shape or rhomboid that just phased in and out of reality. And it was reflecting the sun's light. So it definitely took a form of physicality. There was no question because it was reflecting the sunlight, but at the same time, it was dematerializing and then rematerializing. And it just blew my mind. And at this point, I'm just stood in the middle of the road and there's no cars. I mean, I just didn't, I couldn't even communicate to my wife. And she said, what are you looking at? And I said, come. And by the time she actually made it into the road, it had finished. But it gave me the proof that I needed to know that, you know, sometimes seeing is believing, like doubting Thomas from the Bible. He had to see the nails in the hands of Christ. So yeah, that was the first, that was before we began house hunting and I had all these kind of paranormal experiences in the house. So it was like within 2 to 3 years, I was having this kind of whistle stop tour and experiencing paranormal phenomena in you know, not full spectrum, but you know, getting along the way. And that set me up really, I suppose, for coming to Mauritius, where things just exponentially increased to another level. And to the point where, you know, I research it daily. And it's a passion. What can I say?
Yeah.
It's a passion for truth. Like you know, we want to know the truth. It's not because we're looking to believe in something. We see evidence, but we want to understand the evidence. What does it mean? And I think that the meaning of this is the hardest thing of all. And this is where we see the polarities and the polarization between the research community. Oh, it's this. Well, we're in touch with this particular species, and that's, you know, the gospel. Or I'm channeling these particular beings without any kind of evidence, but okay. And this is how it is. But I think we need to look at all of it. It's empirical evidence. The level above that, in my opinion, is it's a spiritual path. It's not just simply a scientific and exploratory study. And as in the words of Jacques Vallée, who once famously wrote in one of his books on cases that deal with the multidimensional aspect, which is something that I'm particularly interested in, he says that we are not dealing with an alien invasion, but we are dealing with a spiritual system that uses and is used by humans. And by that, I think he's saying that we're interacting with this phenomena, this force, but it's also dependent on us. So, you know, where do we draw the dividing line? We're looking at it from just our perspective. Maybe we're, you know, like the one-eyed man being king. We don't, you know, we think we've understood, we think we're looking at something, we think it's extraterrestrial from another point of origin within the physical cosmos or universe that we can perceive. But I think it's far more than that. I think it is that, but far more. It's coming in and out of this dimension and reality. There are different densities and dimensions, in my opinion, that are supporting this. But I think we need to look at it like an onion. And I think that when we keep peeling away the layers of the onion, we are getting into the esoteric and the spiritual, and need to start trying to understand through knowledge within, not just, and by that I don't mean a belief system which is of the mind. I mean from the heart, which is the center of intelligence of the body. It's the most electromagnetic organ and part of the body, far more than the brain. So, and you know, the Gnostics called this gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, gnosis, knowledge from within. So I think that ultimately that's where it leads, but it's an amazing journey. And I've seen and experienced quite a lot. I mean, there are others that will have conscious memories of boarding craft. I can't say that that's happened to me in physical reality. I can't be sure. Maybe there are memories that have been blocked. I don't really know. But I know I've had other kinds of experiences where that's happened within the lucid dream state or astral projection, we can call it too. So it is a multidimensional phenomena. It does materialize and dematerialize within our consensus reality. It absolutely manipulates gravity, time, and space, that we know. It cohabits these other dimensions. It may not necessarily be just from one other dimension. Maybe when I say cohabit, it literally is transversal. It adapts to and or is adapted by a consciousness. I think that's another aspect to this.
That's what I was just going to say, that it has to be connected to our consciousness, because each individual can experience a completely different experience with different beings, different types of beings. But I think the phenomenon kind of conforms to each individual's consciousness and the collective consciousness during the time period. We can see how the UFO phenomenon has changed from, you know, airships to metallic ships to now these light ships. It seems to be evolving with human consciousness. And another thing, sure there may be some of these beings that are actually traveling from different galaxies on these ships, but I think there is actually a whole other world just beyond the view of our electromagnetic spectrum that exists at all times, and they just can tap into our reality at will.
I agree. And to build on the point of this kind of consciousness connection, I think it was Jacques Vallée that also said that these UFOs, you know, they are physical manifestations, but they can't simply be understood alone. You really need to study the psychic and symbolic reality that they hold too. And that's why it leads into this spiritual system that acts on humans and uses humans. So, you know, as and I completely agree with you, Chris, I think that, you know, they're not, they are perhaps spacecraft in the ordinary nuts and bolts sense. They're coming here, but they're also craft that are in this reality that come out of this reality, then come back in again. And then there are craft that are outside of this reality that are coming into this reality and then removing themselves back into theirs and more. Some of them maybe are not doing it simply technologically, and they're doing it inherently. You know, they're literally got, they've got this, this technology. I don't even want to say biological, because it's beyond the biology of the body. It's multidimensional. So, you know, I think, there's a lot that can be said for this. And, you know, when I think of, amazing journalists and researchers, like John Keel, back in the 60s and 70s, I believe, there were these kinds of physical traces that were being left behind, often in these UFO landing cases, cases where we were seeing creatures or scary monsters kind of thing. You know, these were really seen by witnesses that were contacting the police and getting the sheriff, and they were emptying rounds of ammunition at these things, which they just wouldn't do unless they saw something. And there were traces. There were, I think it was silicon carbide, which is like sand or glass, the, you know, the basis of that. They were literally melting or disappearing. There would often be, I think it was a form of sulfate or sulfide, which smells like rotten eggs, a gas. You could smell this kind of strange smell around the time that these apparitions were appearing. And, you know, when it was scientifically investigated, there was no evidence or trace for it, but it was absolutely present. People were falling ill. There was evidence of fluorocarbons, you know, the stuff that basically helped to erode the ozone layer. So, I mean, it's not all love and light. It may not be intentional to harm the percipients or the contactees, but there is, and what's strange is it's not, they know these are not materials that are unidentified. They're absolutely measurable and linked to the earth, but they're appearing when these manifestations occur. So it could be that, you know, common elements that we're familiar with are necessary in order for them to project and manifest, and then I suppose sustain their presence while here. And that, you know, I'm not just talking about humanoids from this dimension that, you know, can come here, but may need some kind of life support or apparatus to do that or not. So, you know, there's a real enigma, I think is the right word, around this. It's
totally.
I mean, it's mind blowing. And anybody that says that they've really understood everything or that it is absolutely, this is the case because it's coming from this source, you're missing the point. There is an ecosystem at play, and it's multidimensional, and it cannot be sort of tapped and then put in a container and shown up for the world to see. And that's what it's just so elusive. And when I went to Las Vegas after the conference, Chris, and I met up with my friend George Knapp, and we did an interview together, and that's going to be coming out soon on Mystery Wire, I believe. And one of the last things he said to me is, you know, John, I'm not even sure this is that we're ever going to really fully understand this frustrating reality. And I mean, George is at the cutting edge with Jeremy Corbell at the Skinwalker Ranch, where we know the US government are studying this. And there are secret studies that have been going on, the BASS project, BASS, which I didn't even know about until recently. We knew about, you know, ATIP, Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. But this whole other study into deeper paranormal phenomena has been going on in parallel, and it's been going on for a long time. and they still can't figure it out. And
what did you, know, you say that was bass?
Bass, as in sea bass or bass, the instrument. B dot, A dot, S dot, S dot.
What does that, do you know what that stands for?
I can't remember, but I just sort of came to me, the bass study. It must be the word study comes at the end on the last S. But
I would imagine so.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're right. There's so many layers to this phenomenon. It's like peeling an onion. And I would have to agree with George that I don't think we may ever completely understand this. But we have to look at all aspects, like you're saying. We can't put things in a certain compartment and you know, say that this is the way it is 100%. We have to look at all
aspects. Yeah, that's right.
Now, I want to get into what brought you to Mauritius and then some of the experiences you had there.
Okay, well, look, I am now Mauritian. I speak French fluently, and I can speak a little bit of Mauritian Creole, which is lexically based on French. But they say in Creole, it's the language without the bones. It's you get it in other, you know, former French colonies like Haiti and Tahiti. And it's a very musical and melodic type language without any structure, but it's got its own art form to it. And it actually was deeply based in numerology at one point. It was a really amazing language, which has kind of been lost. But yeah, the reason we came here is because my wife is originally from here. And we met in the UK in 2002, and we married in 2011. We then went through this process of experiencing the paranormal together when we were in the UK. Our daughter then arrived in January of 2013. And at that point, we decided to come and relocate back to Mauritius for the quality of life with our newborn daughter. And we now have a son who's four. So, you know, that was really and we both speak French fluently. So it was not too hard a decision to make. I mean, it is a developing world country, which has its challenges. It's a former colony of the Dutch, Holland, and then France, and then the UK or England at the time, the British. So it's known a very sort of short-lived and difficult and painful history with slavery. So it's still catching up. It's a developing world country, as I mentioned. But so yeah, it was really for family reasons that we relocated here. I'm an English barrister and a solicitor by trade, which is an attorney, the equivalent of an attorney. There's a historical division in England where the profession really began. And it's taken time. It's taken me 6 years to acquire nationality here, which means that I can then take the steps to joining the bar here. So it's been a very long and at times challenging process. I've lived through corruption and fraud, seen that kind of thing happening here, which is often associated with the offshore world. But, you know, I don't think you don't change who you are. If you have your values and your, you know, a certain way of being, your integrity, that's not something you learn or change. It's just something you are. So I kind of had to go through that. But it was at that time when a lot of the phenomena began. But anyway, coming back a step, we moved here in 2013, mid-2013, and pretty much straight away after moving here, we moved into the upstairs apartment of my in-law's home at the time. And the first sort of real UFO experience I had was in September of 2013. And my father-in-law just said to me, you know, JP, could you just move the car? We've got a neighbor that needs to get in. Would you just mind moving your car? And I said, sure. So I went outside, stood next to the car, was about to put the key into the lock or near to it. I'm sort of looking up, and there was this enormous elliptical shaped object that was just sitting in the sky. I mean, it was huge. It would have been miles in length and diameter. And I estimated, and actually it was situated over a place called Albion. And Albion is an old English word for England, where I'd just come from. So I was looking at this sort of enormous object, and I'm saying to myself, I think I've probably overdone it. I'm tired. I'm just going to go to bed. I'm perhaps hallucinating, or I don't know, maybe it's something explicable. I'm just going to move the car, go to bed. So I went to bed. Next morning, I woke up. I'm sat downstairs in the kitchen, you know, nibbling on something for breakfast, listening to the radio, and the radio starts to flood in with calls from listeners who had seen exactly the same thing that I'd seen. So, you know, this thing was absolutely there. It hit the radio stations, but there was nothing printed in the press. Unusually, I mean, there's not, you know, huge amounts that go on here by, you know, advanced Western world standards. I mean, it's more like international reporting and incidences on the country than, you know, economic forces, business, that kind of thing, than anything else. So, you know, I thought that was interesting. Why wouldn't this be in the written press, which is in French? But it was all over the radio, and then, you know, people just move on and forget about it. So that was the first major experience. And what was interesting with that was that in later years, so I'm talking about 3 years later, I met a witness of a major case here that happened to be chasing that object, my first major sighting here, on that very evening. And not only that, and this is something that comes out of all the literature and speaking to researchers like George Knapp and others, there is this element of entanglement, or the mirror effect, where you are being fed or put into contact with people that link to events that may have happened to you, or ideas that you may have had about the subject. So amazing. You could, you know, you can't predict anything like that. And there we were, 3 years later, I'm discussing or interviewing this witness about a massive craft that appeared over the West Coast that was the equivalent to the Phoenix Lights of March 1997 over Phoenix in Arizona. Same kind of scale, a lot more colorful, I would say, more aesthetic.
You called it the Tamarin Lights, right?
That's right. That's right. It was called the Tamarin Lights. And it just so happened that, you know, in the prelude, before talking about the case and going into it in detail, we were just sharing about our respective experiences. And this was a major experience he had. He was literally, on that night, on that first major sighting I had, he was chasing this thing. And it was huge. It was stationary when I saw it. But when he was on the coast trying to get closer to it, he said this thing moved really fast and that it almost landed in one of the sugarcane fields. And in fact, I think he said that it did. And then it, you know, elevated itself and took off. I mean, this thing was huge. It was miles in width. It's been a little bit like that, kind of lots of strange connections. But if you like, I'll talk to you about that, the Tamarin Lights, if you like.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because didn't your friend also have sort of like a contact experience during this?
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you a little bit of more background into him and the case, because it just sort of almost normalizes what this case was about. I mean, it's absolutely incredible, but it's for somebody like that or myself, it sort of becomes part of the experience. And not another aspect of this was, I think it was July in 2015. So this case, the Tamarin Lights, happened on the 27th of August in 2010. So, you know, a little bit before my arrival into Mauritius. Fast forward to July 2015, my mum was visiting us here and, you know, seeing her new granddaughter and grandson, I should say. And, you know, I went to the local shop to pick up some supplies, which I can't do at the moment with martial law. But as I'm coming out of the shop, it must have been around 7:30 p.m. just before closing. I go out the front door. I see this white orb slowly crossing the night sky in front of me towards one of the mountains. And it's at quite a high altitude. And this mountain is called Thumb Mountain because it literally looks like a thumb being held up like that. So this orb just, it's traversing the sky and it sort of fades into invisibility. And I'm just thinking, okay, that was interesting. I've seen this before. Okay, nice. Not a big deal. But then suddenly this eruption of flashing lights just appeared out of the darkness. It was like, a 5 mile plus Christmas light show, but in the shape of a boomerang or a curve or a delta. And not only that, these sort of fairy lights or lights were kind of dancing in a serpentine-like fashion. It was very fluid and almost like a dance. The lights were dancing, but it was very much around this boomerang shape whilst these lights are streaming or rippling in this sequence. And it was really clear to me. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I always look at things objectively and I make notes. I've got hundreds of pages of notes, hundreds and hundreds of them. And the key word that I used to describe the lights was serpentine. And that happened maybe three times. And it probably took up to, I don't know, 10 to 20 seconds max. But it was enough. It was incredible. So anyway, that's July 2015. That happens to me. I was talking earlier about this sort of concept of mirroring or entanglement. Shortly afterwards, I want to say within a matter of 2 to 3 months max, a fellow lawyer friend of mine who works for the public prosecution here, the director of public prosecutions, tells me about a cousin of his. And through somebody else, we get put in touch because I'd heard that this guy had had an experience and seen a large craft off the West Coast in Tamarin, like you mentioned, Chris. And at the time, back in 2015, I think he was 37. So anyway, what I didn't realize those months before was that I was actually seeing what I was about to be told about and handed the video for. So, you know, very strange. So anyway, I meet this guy, I finally get to meet him. He's a, you know, physically very, very strong. He works out. He did an undergraduate degree in musicology, I think, which is a sort of focus on musical performance. And he coupled it with philosophy and studied that at the Sorbonne, at the University of Paris 1, which is like their Oxford University in France. He then came back to Mauritius, which is his home. And, you know, he wanted to come back. So anyway, there's this connection. I've seen these lights. I go to visit him. I know his cousin very well, as does my wife. I then find out about that major first experience that I mentioned earlier about that took place in September of 2013. So I'm like, okay, that's really weird. Here's another coincidence, or is it? I mean, I don't really believe in coincidences, but you know, I work with it. He then starts to tell me that, you know, he's had a number of other experiences that he believed or believes that he was being monitored by intelligence agencies. I mean, he would be messaging, or sorry, he'd be looking at Google Earth over Area 51 in Nevada, and then suddenly a message would come up on his computer to literally say, stop doing what you're doing. We can tell what you're looking at. Stop it, which is weird. Because, I mean, Area 51 is known about. It's not anything new, but still kind of strange. Like myself, he had an incident of dehydrating, which is physiologically explainable. And, you know, we live in a tropical environment. I've got my water now, so I'm not going to make the same mistake twice. And basically he passed out because he hadn't had enough water, like me, and had a very unusual higher consciousness experience. And ironically, water is sacred in, you know, Native American and other traditions, and it's the conduit to higher consciousness. So, you know, lack of water leading to higher consciousness type experiences, it's interesting, symbolic. And anyway, during that experience, he went to the hospital, was followed by UFOs to the hospital. They then put him on a drip, just saline drip, rehydrated him, brought him back. And all these sort of orbs were above his home. And his friends were with him because they were just looking after him, keeping an eye on him. They wanted to call all their friends and say, my God, there's these orbs, there's these objects above our home. They couldn't make the phone calls. There was something blocking the calls from leaving their mobile phones. But when they experimented, whilst these UFOs were above the apartment, they could make phone calls in and amongst themselves. So, you know, there was network, but they could only actually make calls on their carrier network amongst themselves whilst these UFOs are above their heads. So, I mean, strange.
Yes, that is absolutely fascinating.
Another experience, I mean, honestly, Chris, you can't make this up. It's insane. Another experience with the witness. He had a friend over. He's watching the Ice Age film from the, I don't know if it's Disney or some other kind of animation house, watching the DVD at home. For some reason, they fall asleep. The house is locked. There's just him and his friend. They wake up maybe an hour later. The apartment was totally disorderly and messy, by the way, as they're watching this. They wake up. The entire apartment had been cleaned. The DVD was no longer on, and they couldn't find it. I mean, it was strange enough that their apartment was cleaned and there was no one else in the apartment and nobody else that had come in or out of the apartment as they were asleep for the hour. Next day, he goes into his fridge or his freezer and then sees the Ice Age DVD placed perfectly squarely in the middle of the freezer. Ice Age, freezer, ice. It's like a sort of a game or a sort of trickster element of some kind that was, you know, happening here. So, you know, lots of strange examples surrounding witnesses such as him and myself. And it's almost like it's having fun, whatever this it is or intelligence. And I think that, you know, the trickster element is very much an archetype from Jungian psychology. And I think it just it's just something that exists within, let's call it the universal order. So this is a really prevalent element that I find. So anyway, we finally get on to the Tamarin Lights case. And I mean, the footage had been kept on a hard drive. He'd not shared it with anyone other than, I think, two other people, one who was with him, and then a friend who just looked after it for safekeeping. So I got the footage shortly after we had this meeting, and he told me about it. But to take you through the case, he says that the events took place between 1:30 and 6:30 a.m. on that morning of the 27th of August in 2010. And this is basically on the side of a really a beautiful mountain. It's not huge, but it's quite sizable. And it's situated on the west coast at a town or outside of a town called Tamarin. And they produce some of the finest sea salt in the world there. There are salt flats. He'd just been, I suppose, just relaxing with his, I think it was four other friends that evening. And they just wanted to sort of skywatch on the side of the mountain. So that's what they did. And they're just watching the night sky. And then at 1:30 a.m., they start to see lights that just suddenly come online or appear. And they start to dance around. Thing I should mention is, you know, in 2010, as an adjunct to the side, is that, you know, the camera technology isn't great, but what they'd managed to pick up with this, I think it was a Sony SLR, and the footage is from around 3 a.m., although this had been going on from 1:30 till around 6:30 a.m., is actually pretty good. So, you know, I just wanted to bear that in mind once your viewers or listeners see it. And actually, I think we're going to have to play this on the Forbidden Knowledge News online conference we're going to be having. So I think that's why I'm going to show it. So everybody, you should sign up for that. So basically, they've got this 2010 Sony SLR, and they're observing these lights. They're moving at different speeds over the ocean, morphing. At one point, they took, I think it was the shape of a W, which I've seen on a separate occasion, different kind of experience. But he then described them as moving very quickly in a serpent-like fashion. And he was very specific about the use of the word serpent-like, which is exactly how I described what I saw in 2015, in July 2015, when I had mentioned the experience I had coming out of the supermarket close by. So, that was interesting. And at this point, I hadn't seen the footage, so I couldn't identify it as identical or, you know, really being very closely similar to what I had seen. So at a certain point in this experience, it kind of becomes clear to the group that the lights formed one part of one and the same object, but this thing was huge. And at this point in time, when they start filming, the lights stop flashing, and they begin to align with one another to form this huge delta-shaped craft. There is this kind of one large central red light that appears in the center of the craft, and it kind of then moves up to one side, and you can see the boomerang-type shape of all these beautiful, like, fairy lights. And he estimated the size of this craft to be up to 2 football fields in breadth. So it's pretty huge. So after several hours of viewing this light show, he and his 3 friends go and rest for a little while in their car. and it's sort of on the end of this road on the side of the mountain. The witness is sat in the front passenger seat. You've got another friend sat in the driver's seat. And then the two companions are obviously sat behind in the rear. So all four occupants are there in the car together. And then suddenly they feel a kind of breeze penetrate the vehicle. And the witness said that this kind of breeze was accompanied by what sounded like a whisper stating his name. So the witness then instinctively looked into the passenger rearview mirror, which would be on the left, and was stunned to momentarily glimpse or see a clothed being the size of a child, he says, that was rapidly moving through the tall grass just behind the car. And it was just situated at the rear. And interestingly, he sort of clearly recalls seeing this being parting the blades with its hands, and the fingers were very long. And it made very quick, stealthy, and purposeful strides through the grass, crosses the road, and then over to the other side. And he said he recoiled, he jumped, he was, you know, shocked, as you would be. When I asked him, can you identify the being or associate it with some kind of description? He said that it was quite difficult to tell because of the lighting, obviously, it was dark. But after a lot of reflection and meditating on it, he says he felt fairly sure that it was a member of one of the many reported gray species, but he couldn't be certain. So, I mean, that was fair enough. He was making a sort of a guesstimate based on close reflection and, you know, the knowledge he'd acquired after this experience. So, you know, there's this enormous craft, dominates the skyline, beautiful light show like I saw. There's possibly a gray that is just making itself known to them behind them, and you can hear his name being whispered. And then around 6:30 a.m. latest, the sun begins to rise over the coast, on the west coast at Tamarin. And at this point, he says that the craft kind of instantaneously vanished or melted away into invisibility as the sunlight broke and hit the craft. So he thinks it was probably a cloaking device of some kind that was automatically activated, but it was almost like the sunlight just melted this thing. Like, you know, we hear about vampires and sunlight, it just vanished. So it was an amazing story, and I was very lucky. He gave me the footage. They managed to extract it from a sort of a hard drive tower, and he said that I could use it however I wanted, but it was important to him that I keep his details anonymous because he didn't want to be harassed or ridiculed. And it, you know, the same stood for his three friends who accompanied him on that evening. So, you know, I was very lucky to meet them, or him, I should say, and see this footage, which I've got. And as I said, I'm very happy to show that at the Forbidden News conference that's going to take place in May.
Definitely.
So it's really amazing. It's so beautiful and dazzling, hypnotic, I would even say or suggest. So that was the Tamarin lights of August in 2010. And they're very sort of similar in terms of the scale and the shape as the Phoenix lights that took place on the 13th of March in 97. But I would say it was more colorful, more of a demonstration in terms of the movement, whereas the Phoenix lights were, I mean, they were amazing, and they just appeared, this huge craft just appeared and hovered. But coming back to talking about the Phoenix lights, this sort of contriving or orchestration element, coincidences, synchronicities, the mirror. The very first pilot, in fact, I believe it was the only pilot to be in the sky at the time of the Phoenix lights to call it in, was none other than the A-list actor, Kurt Russell. I mean, what are the chances of that? Why him? Why would he be there at that very moment calling this in? Because I suppose it draws attention. Maybe they wanted to be seen. So there is this, I want to say, organized, nothing is left to chance, in my opinion, element that, you know, we can see through the Phoenix lights too. I mean, there were thousands of witnesses, But it just so happened that, you know, the first pilot, or maybe the only pilot to call it in, was Kurt Russell. Very strange.
That is very strange.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of this organized element, I know here in the United States, a lot of UAP and UFO phenomenon is mistaken. It may be military craft. Is mm-hmm. there a lot of military activity in Mauritius, or any at all?
I would say, look, no. On an official and logistical basis, no, absolutely not, because Mauritius doesn't have any armed forces, you know, army, navy, air force. No, there is a coast guard, but there's no official or formal military structure. There are military police and then the police, but that's it. There is an intelligence agency, but I think that it's probably more politically led than the other way around, which is what we see in the West. And I think that, you know, intelligence is kind of where you know, the kind of cutting edge of knowledge on the subject is, in addition to these so-called special access projects. And then there's contactees at the grassroots level. So, you know, it's nobody's got a firm tap on this. Even I would say, you know, the kind of super high value special access projects that are actually building these craft, I mean, that's still limited. That's still limitation, because the beings are never going to give them anything that's going to outsmart them. And, you know, so I don't worry about that too much. I think that there's, like I said, there's this ecosystem that we're amongst, and it's a spiritual system. Ultimately, you can have all the technology and fritter billions or trillions worth of taxpayer dollars on special access projects that are probably anti-constitutional, but it still doesn't really get to the essence of where this can ultimately lead. That's technology. And you've got to ask yourself, why would a highly advanced species want to give you this technology when you're just using it for private and, you know, self-interest purposes? So, you know, we just need to be a little bit wise about it. We can have all the intelligence in the world, but there needs to be wisdom too, to really, I suppose, try and access the truth with a capital T.
Now, you said that you've never, that you know of, been taken on any craft or had any, direct contact, but have you ever had any, experiences with some sort of intelligence, out of body, other than the one you had as a child, or any type of encounter that could possibly be a part of this phenomenon that we're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, we look at the work of Dr. John Mack from Harvard University, who was a formidable intellect, who I believe passed before his time in a car accident. And he, you know, he rigorously and fearlessly researched and pursued the abduction phenomena. And to cut a long story short, his view was this is absolutely real, but it's happening either or in physical reality and metaphysical reality. So the dream state, that kind of thing. I can't say that I've had an experience in physical reality, because I just can't recall it. I have not had that experience. But I have had experiences where I've either been asleep having a lucid type experience, or in meditation. And I have had these kinds of experiences. And I think that the dream state or altered states of consciousness is very much a preferred mode of contact for a lot of people, because it's not as it's, in a way, it's simpler, because you're not having to physically remove the person from their environment, although I'm sure that this does happen and there are means for this to happen, because they can manipulate time and space and gravity. That's what the cases talk about. But I have had an experience that was, you know, fundamentally metaphysical with beings around me. But it was also corroborated with photographic evidence of an object or a UFO that appeared above our home, or in the vicinity above our home, at that precise moment in time. Again, another coincidence perhaps. So, I mean, what I'm talking about, I mean, I call it the council, because I think it was September of 2015. Yeah. we were living or renting a place in the same area that we live in now, maybe 500 meters away from where I'm sat right now. And I recall just being aware of my surroundings in the bedroom at the time whilst I was asleep. And I knew I was asleep. But at the same time, I could look around the room 360 degrees. I could see that the alarm clock was exactly at 4 a.m., which would have been sort of just before the sunrise at that particular time of year, because that's our summer in September. And I was surrounded by, I'm looking around the room, and then suddenly I'm surrounded by several white or pale white looking beings, dressed in some kind of material. I don't know what. It was sort of silvery looking, white, I suppose. They had large, pale heads. I've got to say the truth. You know, this is exactly what they look like. I wouldn't say they were grays. They were much paler than what, you know, we're led to believe by looking at the kind of empirical evidence on the grays. I felt comfortable. I felt safe. And I felt like I was in a meeting or a kind of, they were rooting for me. It was, you know, there was no verbal communication. It was all feelings and information constructs, or telepathy, I would actually say as well. But they were literally surrounding me, and they were smaller than me. And I can't for the life of me remember what it was they were telling me. I mean, as I said, it wasn't verbal, but it was like they were, you know, you need, it was like something, this is what you got to do. I have no idea what that was. I've had other experiences, but this one really stood out because it was so clear. I remembered everything. I knew the time, and then 20 minutes later, I woke up. Boom, woke up. It's 4:20 a.m. And that's in waking consciousness. So I was right. What I was seeing in the dream state was the time was 4 a.m. And then I've woken up and it's 4:20. So I know that 20 minutes has passed, but the experience felt like it happened, I suppose, much longer. So there was a distortion in that kind of perception of time in this lucid dream type state. So anyway, it was pretty weird. It was amazing at the time. I'm seeing a lot of UFOs around where we live. I mean, I go swimming in the local swimming pool, and I get in the pool. There'd be myself and perhaps another person. And then this sort of X-shaped object would just appear, fly over the pool slowly, silently, no sound, and then land and change color and land in the sugarcane field just next to where this sports center is. So, I mean, a lot of stuff was going on around this time. My son had arrived a few months beforehand. And then I have this kind of lucid type contact experience with a group of small pale white beings surrounding me. Come just under 2 weeks later, I'm at a birthday party just down the road from where we are now. And I meet this Australian guy who is animated and funny, very witty, very smart. And it turns out that he's basically one of the few master photographers that lives in Mauritius. And by master photographers, I mean, he does like international photo shoots for the likes of Condé Nast and, you know, huge publications. So he's really good at what he does. He has a good eye for detail and, you know, how to take photographs very, very well. So anyway, during the celebrations, we're outside. And I don't know how we broached the subject of UFOs. We're outside, we're looking at the stars, and maybe he said it'd be great if we saw something tonight. So I suppose that was kind of the inroad into that conversation. You know, I remember there were some kind of Chinese lanterns that had been lit and they were put out in the air. And then he then began to tell me about an event that happened whilst he was driving home from a friend's home in Tamarin, where the case happened that I just walked us through in 2010. And he had to get up early to start preparing for a photo shoot. And he woke up, I mean, really early. He woke up at a goal, left their house at 3:30 a.m. And at 4 a.m., he's coming down the motorway, which is a couple of miles or a mile or so away from where we are. And for the first time in his life, he sees this UFO in the sky on the motorway. And for the first time in his life, he stops his car. And then he gets out of his car. I mean, at this time in the morning, there's nothing on the motorway. It was safe to do that. And he had his iPhone with him. And he said that, you know, he's never seen anything like this before. He pulled up on the motorway and it was actually parallel to or just past the kind of business district, which is exactly level to where we are in Mocha, which is in the center. And so he gets out of his car, he gets out his iPhone, and he takes a photo. So he took the photo, he's got the timestamp, the date and the time are on this photo. And he's like, yeah, no, it was actually a couple of weeks ago. And it was around 4 a.m. And I'm looking through my, you know, I told him about the lucid dream I had in which I was apparently interacting with a group of these otherworldly beings who wouldn't allow me to recall all of their physical or whatever their identity was or the conversation or communication, let's call it, was about. But then he says to me, yeah, it was around the same day and around the same time. Let me check. Take your details. I'll send you the photo. So he did. He, you know, followed up, did exactly what he said. I looked at the timestamp. It was at exactly that precise moment in September, the 17th of September of 2015, that I was having that experience, and he'd captured a UFO over where we were living at that precise moment. So, you know, it's corroboration of a kind, but it was like, you know, what are the chances of meeting a master photographer who happened to be coming home, crossing the island to get to his home in the east at that precise moment in time that I'm having this experience? Again, it's sort of, it feels like orchestration, synchronicity, that kind of thing. So that was a clear kind of experience that I've had. I have had other experiences where I've seen entities, I suppose, in the home. But that was quite special because, like I said, I think we need to be objective in our analysis and respect the scientific method. But we also need to accept and go beyond what we know and just explore things. And for me, this kind of gave a nice kind of conjunction between the metaphysical and the physical. And I suppose it gave credence to what was quite literally an unbelievable experience.
So definitely. There we are. Yeah, that is absolutely fascinating. JP, we have a few minutes left. If there's any cases or personal stories, anything that you want to leave us with tonight before we close out?
I mean, look, I don't think I'll go into more cases and so on. I mean, all right, maybe there's one thing that I will mention, because you know what, Chris, I think you're one of the few people that picked up on this as well. When I sort of did some research on the internet. And so I think I will say it, because this is kind of, again, we look at coincidences, that kind of thing. And it does tie into an appearance in the house. But anyway, to cut a long story short, on, I think it was the 30th of June in 2016, there's a very well-known British astronomer called Paul Cox, who gave a kind of, I think it was a 30-minute Q&A on astronomy generally. It was like a live Q&A. It was on the 30th of June 2016. There were about 11,000 viewers at the time. There's now been around 23,000 views. And he answered lots of questions, and he was very he seemed upset, genuinely upset, and genuinely addressing the issue of a cover-up on UFOs, and I've got to say it, a second sun within our solar system. And he just didn't seem to be joking or messing around. And it's not the first time that he's spoken about this. And this is something that you, Chris, have picked up, and not many people have. For some reason, he did read out one of my questions. I mean, he was saying things like, astronomers had detected gravitational waves near the outer planets, Neptune, Uranus, and beyond, that indicates the so-called dark planet. But he said, not Nibiru, or Planet X, whatever we want to call it. And he also said, as a SLU astronomer, he could say that UFOs do exist and that he's not being flippant. And flippant just means, you know, off-the-cuff humor. He said that alien spaceships do exist, but they're likely to be orbiting other planets. He'd said that he'd been told that he wasn't allowed to comment on the so-called second sun, and that Stu, or whoever this questioner was, might know that he, the astronomer Paul Cox, got into trouble for that. But he has seen a UFO, and he's been warned that he's not allowed to talk about that, and he's not allowed to talk about this second sun. I mean, it was pretty strange.
I remember the broadcast. He was doing a transit of Mercury, and he said, to the right of the sun, that's our second sun. NASA hides that stuff from us and doesn't like to talk about it, but yeah, it's there. He was very nonchalant about saying it.
That's right. And this transit of Mercury program, which you're referring to, came before. And then he did this sort of generic 30-minute Q&A afterwards, which I just happened to turn on my laptop and it sort of popped up. I thought, yeah, this sounds great. I'm going to have a look. And then he started to say all this stuff. And this was after the transit of Mercury broadcast. And there were thousands of people watching, hundreds and hundreds of questions. And he just so happened to pick out my question. And my question was, Paul, did you get into trouble for talking about the second sun? Or again, is this humor? And then he picks out my question and he says, yes, I did get into a lot of trouble talking about the second sun, which is why I'm not allowed to talk about it now. And you could see he was visibly distressed or dissatisfied by the answer that he could give. And, this is a 30-minute Q&A. My intuition was is that he was genuine. He's intelligent, obviously, and very open-minded. And that he has had some kind of contact of a kind, because this isn't something you would mess around with. If you're a professional astronomer working with a reputable organization, you don't play around with this kind of information. It's a bit like me being in a courtroom and then just completely discrediting my client who's paying me my fees and losing the case for him. Why would I do that? There's absolutely no reason unless I've lost my mind. And I don't think that I have. And I certainly don't think that Paul Cox had either. So anyway, he said, well, I can't really talk about this. But then he did. He said, well, sorry, I did talk about a second sun during a show covering the transit of the planet Mercury, like you said, Chris, across the sun. And he then says, I said that we saw our second sun and NASA hide that stuff up. And I've been told that I must not talk about it anymore. I mean, it was just weird. In the Mercury transit video that you mentioned that you saw and that he was referring to that had happened before, in that show, the camera was fixed on the sun and then this bright object very, very close to it to the right. And then he says, you may be asking yourself, what is that large round thing to the right of the sun? Well, that's our second sun. And I don't know if you knew this, but we had a second sun, but there it is. It's normally hidden from view. NASA and other organizations, they usually hide that stuff away from us. They don't tell us the truth, but there it is. This is what he said, word for word, Chris. And he kept going on about it. But I was absolutely amazed to sort of listen to this. And I then turn around to the left. I'm sat on the sofa just here. And I can hear my son, S-O-N, not S-U-N, that we were talking about, cry. He just suddenly wakes up crying, and this is in the evening. As I turn, I can see this hazy type, distorted outline or image of a humanoid shape just literally walking down the stairs quite slowly. And it was a bit like light was being bent around it. I think of, I don't want to say it, but I will because it's fun, the Predator film with Arnold Schwarzenegger, or the series. And you can see the kind of distortion of this thing. But I mean, that was a large, scary bad guy. I mean, this wasn't. It was a small humanoid-shaped thing. But it was like the light was being bent and distorted around it. And it was walking down the stairs, and then it just disappeared. The very moment that I had stopped listening to this amazing Q&A with Paul Cox from SLU, I then looked up some NASA kind of information about the sun. There is a video and research on what they call X points, or hidden magnetic portals that are situated around the Earth. But they kind of disparage or dismiss this. And they say, well, there are these electron diffusion regions where the magnetic fields of both the sun and the Earth crisscross. But, we can't really find them. The sun's 93 million miles away. These so-called X points or electron diffusion points, they open and close dozens of times a day, some 30,000 kilometers above the Earth. But yeah, we don't really know where they are. So, I mean, that's what NASA are publicly saying about this. I then see this thing walking down the stairs, and my son was crying quite a lot after this. I suppose this thing had kind of been into his room. I don't really know. my wife goes in and kind of spends the night on his bed. So I just kind of, I slept downstairs and I'm literally trying to fall asleep. And all I'm seeing is this kind of burning image of this kind of large head, black obsidian eyes, humanoid, not unpleasant or scary or negative in any way. And I'm just thinking, this is a lot of information to process within, you know, a space of an hour or two. So, you know, it's incredible. There is one final thing, Chris, that I'd like to end on, if I may, and that's a quote. And the quote comes from Charles Fort. Now, you will remember from the Laughlin UFO Megacon that Jordan Maxwell, who was given a Lifetime Achievement Award, spoke about when he met and had a so-called ET girlfriend. She was human-looking, but very different, very special. He then was taken back home to her home where her parents lived and met the father. And the father seemed to be able to invoke or call over flying saucers or UFOs. And during that meeting, he then gave Jordan the book. And that book was by Charles Fort. And it talks about all these kind of strange, mysterious things in the world that people aren't really thinking about, and arcana, that kind of thing. And anyway, in this book, Charles Fort says the following, and I think that this kind of sums it up. And I don't want, you know, the viewers or listeners to take it in a negative sense. I want it to engender humility and open-mindedness when listening to this. So he says, "I think we are property. I should say we belong to something. That once upon a time, this earth was no man's land. That other worlds explored and colonized here and fought amongst themselves for possession. But that now it's owned by something. That something owns this earth. All others are warned off." And I think that something is not necessarily physical. It's not a dominating, colonizing force or group of beings. I think it's something far more powerful and superior. And we're talking about the order of universal creation and hierarchy of creation and manifestation and the management and communication that happens within this spiritual system that Jacques Vallée spoke about, that we opened with. So I just want to bring it back to this kind of idea of a greater force that really perhaps regulates everything in its entirety and everything in its microcosm, and man, it's a man, you know, ourselves. So nothing to worry about, nothing we can do about it. All we can do is try to go within, research, respect science, respect the opinions and experiences of others, and try to engender that self sense of knowledge within.
Very well said. JP, thank you so much. That was an awesome conversation. We have so much more we could have talked about. So we're going to have you back on soon. Looking forward to the conference. I know you're going to have an amazing presentation there. Before you head out today, if people want to find more about you and your work, where can they go? Any social media websites or stuff like that?
Yeah, it's JP, JP, and then Haig, H-A-G-U-E. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook. I've also set up a page on Facebook called Ufology Mauritius Indian Ocean, where there's a lot of the stuff that's going on here. And I've also done a few radio shows and conducted a few interviews with some really interesting people on YouTube. And again, that's under JP Haig, H-A-G-U-E. So please subscribe and check it out. And if, you know, you take away something, then that's good.
Very good. JP, thank you so much. And we will talk to you again soon. You have a great rest of your day.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. God bless. And we'll speak soon.